Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we calm when you can't.
So if anyone else trickles in, I'll give the same caveat. But you may have noticed on your tickets, the panel says 11:12. That is the actual time I wanted this panel for. The book says 11:1. I can talk a lot, but maybe not that much. So we'll run to 12 if we run to like 12:15, 12:30. Cool. But I have a game to run at 1, so probably won't go past 12:30. The other caveat is, if you were following the Paizo Forums thread, you noticed that I was going to bring in the first printing of the book. And did you have any luck?
They're going to be bringing it as soon as they possibly can.
Fantastic. So we will eventually have some AV stuff going on with art and stuff for the books and previews for the Intrigue Manual. We'll get more of that later. But I was going to bring the very first printing of the book that came as a proof that had a slightly skewed cover, sign it, and give it to all of you. I let someone borrow it and then forgot to get it back from them. I have a second printing of the book. But, as you would like to notice, I stepped on it and demolished it. So, it's a little loved. But, if someone would love a well-loved copy of this card cover, I might give it out today at the end of the panel. So, it comes with a caveat of the fact that it got stepped on by the creator. Maybe that's a collector's item.
Were you barefoot, Bob? Because then if nothing else, someone could clone you.
I think I was, actually. And then I was on the floor. So
value.
Are you going to start at like a Fender Dome to who gets a win at?
There'll be some Thunderdome elements. We've got axes under the table for all of you.
Winsbury rolls.
So I think this is going to be our panels. We may have one or two more people popping in throughout the panel to talk. But I want to go around and introduce everybody. Starting on my left is the amazing Liz Liddell. She was the managing editor for the entire book, which was supposed to be 300 pages and then became 580. And I'm still here living and breathing, so that's a testament to her patience.
I met Robert this weekend.
Now you can.
I've had some time to cool down.
What?
And you may all know Liz Kortz because she's been around forever and is fantastic. And Liz was our layout artist who managed to make our book look phenomenal. The impression we get from everyone who looks through it is this book is so beautiful. That's all her. To my right is Jacob Thomas. He is the co-creator of Athera. I was in his kitchen having coffee when we first came up with the concept for it in like 2007. And then I promptly forgot about it and did nothing with it for a decade. And he is the mastermind behind pretty much half the settings ideas. And furthest to the right is Jesse Benner. Jesse worked as a freelance author on the book. He wrote Spells and Artifacts. And the artifacts are very intrinsically connected to the lore of the setting, and one of them especially helps you kind of travel between all the worlds. So if you die doing that, blame Jesse.
Space zombies, you're welcome.
And I'm some guy who writes a thing. And some of you may have read stuff about it.
He's a guy doing character creation and travel.
So, the way we're going to do this is the first half of the panel is going to be me and the panelists yammering on about things they did in the book. And the second half of the panel is going to be you yammering at us, asking questions about why did we or did we write the thing. And then when or if we get that HDMI cable, we'll do a little display of some of the art for those who haven't seen the PDF or the hardcover, and for those who haven't seen some of the art that we've been keeping secret for our next book. So, first off, is how many folks actually have the PDF already?
I do.
Okay, good. Then you're all in for a good surprise today. Most of you. So, Athera came about years and years ago. I wanted to make a space fantasy setting for 3.5 Pathfinder. And I wanted it to feel different from the other settings that were around at the time. I was really big into Eberron more recently when I started coming up with this. Prior to that, I kind of cut my teeth on Dark Sun in second edition, and I love the kind of like earthy, gritty, survivalistic feel of that. And those were kind of my inspiration babies going into this. And Jacob and I came up with the idea for Athera over a series of long discussions. We brought in one of our regular gaming group members, Alvin Dixon, and he came up with one of the races for the book that kind of started setting the entire tone for the thing, the Arathi. And he also came up with the nemesis of the setting, the Tor, who I'll talk a little bit about later. Al's contribution kind of set the overarching narrative to the whole setting. I started working on it, and I was going to include the Incarnum rules from 3.5, like pack magic and shadow magic. There was going to be no Arcane or Divine spellcasters. It was just going to be weird magic.
So you basically took that 3.5 book and like, I'm going to use all of these.
Exactly. And then I heard that Paizo was doing Pathfinder, and I'm like, well, hell, the Dragon Magazine stuff was the best thing in years, so okay, I'll wait for the beta to come out. And then I promptly forgot about this and started playing with Larry. A few years ago, are a miracle worker.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll let you handle the connecty bits while I do that. So, a few years ago, I was cleaning out a hard drive, and I found some notes for this from back in the day. And I'm like, well, this will be a good lesson in humility. These are probably awful. This was so long ago. I open it up, and I start flipping through it, and I'm like, did I get worse? So I saw these notes, and I'm like, all right. I show them to the guys, and I'm like, well, is this still good? I'm like, yeah, well, let's do something about it. I think I can do a Kickstarter. So I start putting together some ideas for what a new version of this would look like without any of the Wizards of the Coast product identity, what it would look like in Pathfinder. At PaizoCon 2015, I took a couple of freelancers I'd worked with in the past aside and one by one kind of ran them through my idea for the setting. And all of them came back with, can I work on this? So I'm like, all right, no one looked at me like I was an idiot, so this had to have been something. And from there on, we started putting things together, building a team, and setting up to make this setting. That was kind of the arc for a couple of years. I pulled together a team of 50% new authors, 50% established authors, speaking of which, here come three more. we got one seat up in the front, whoever wants to dibs and join in and talk. Otherwise, feel free to sit up front, and then I'll just point at you and you can chime in from there. adding to introductions, that is Isabel Lee. Isabel worked on like 90% of this book. I don't know how she writes the things she does in the time she does.
If you're creeped out by the chitons in the book, that's the book.
Yeah, I'm going to show you a piece of art just to give you an idea of what is going on inside Isabel's head at any point in time. That thing. That is a kite. And it is abominable, and there are dozens of them. About five in the book. So, they're horrible, and that monster came up with them, and I'm so thankful for it.
You've
got
space
zombies for
that.
I like a space
wendigo. There are space wendigos. David Ross came up with a lot of work for the archetypes, the Arathi. He designed the entire new core class in here, the Cantor, which is a divine spellcasting bard oracle-ish class. They're kind of like musical prophets, and they're very integrated in the lore of the setting with something called the Score, which is a subharmonic cosmic music radiating from the star at the center of the system. That basically has kind of a roadmap of history in it, if you can decipher the mathematics and the music. It's not saying necessarily that X, Y, and Z are going to happen, but that if you do A, B, and C, D will happen. But if you do E, F, and G, maybe something else will happen. So people listen to this music, make bizarre Bible code interpretations of it, and then go about their political schemes thinking that they can control the future. Cantors are basically hardwired into that and can see glimpses of what's to come. David and our freelancer Andrew Fields, who wasn't able to make it this year, did a phenomenal job on that class. And John Bennett designed one of the other really interesting rules for this, which are symbionts. They're plant creatures that can attach to your body and give you effects, kind of like magic items, except they're living creatures and can also climb off you and attack things. So we've got entire suits that can come over you, protect you while you're in the empty vacuum of space, or like a little gun that will ride on your shoulder and shoot things and then climb off for snuggles. And John designed how all those work, also wrote archetypes that get them as animal companions, like a druid. Nick Hite, who just came in, also worked on the book. He did all of the firearms, technology, guns.
You!
Anything with grease, oil, and bullets, he designed, including the Jump Trooper Gunslinger archetype, which is basically Tony Stark's pulse things integrated into a gunslinger. So if you ever wanted to be Tony Stark the Gunslinger, that's in here. We came up with Athera, started building it up. PaizoCon last year, I'm coming in all smiles, and Wes Schneider, may his dark soul rest in peace, came over to me. He's like, I'm going to talk to you about Starfinder, and blew my mind a little bit that it was happening. We almost refit the entire thing to be Starfinder, but I waited until we saw the rules for it, and it's just, it's a different game. It's like Pathfinder, but it would have taken rewriting the entire book. So we decided at the end of the day not to. More guidance. Thank you, Isabel. So at the end of the day, we decided not to go with that. We stuck with Pathfinder, and I think it provides an alternative to folks who don't necessarily want to invest all in buying all the Starfinder books. It's whatever you have for Pathfinder works in this. You want to use the Dreamguard Press Psionic stuff, we don't have, like, where it works in the world, like, what their roles are, but they'll fit, the mechanics will work. Everything that was published by Paizo, up until the point this book was written, is explained in here. So, if, say you want to play an occultist, this book tells you what their societal role is. And in Athera, all those occult classes that are usually fringe are front and center. Like, psychometrists run government offices and figure out what your job should be. Oh, I'm reading your palm. You clearly are, you know, you're a fighter. Okay, we're going to put you in the military. So if you're in the human society, there's a lot of predestination kind of things going on. We wanted to make the setting and the mechanics mesh entirely and not have them divorced. It does make conversions difficult. People have been clamoring for a 5e conversion, and that's been challenging because it would, again, be rewriting. It's not a no, but it's a... But if you're here, you probably know on that one. So, the book is about 580 pages, and it will be released in August in hardcover, if not sooner, because 4,000 pounds of these books are currently sitting in a dock in Tacoma. We almost had them in time for PaizoCon. The timing was just a smidge too short. But you can pre-order the PDF and print at Legendary Games' website, and they would love that. And I would too. You can also pick this up while you're here. Etheric Heroes is the Iconics. It's a set of pre-gens, first level. You can use them to go into the adventures that we'll be putting out later in the year. And you get a free comic book when you pick that up, if there's someone at the Legendary table. So circle around and wait for Jason to show up, and then be like, give me the comic. The comic in question. So, to kind of give a broad overview of like what the set itself is, Athera takes concepts of diesel punk, fantasy, and science fiction, kind of blends them together into something that is very analog. You're not going to find video cameras. You're not going to find computers. Everything in Athera is around a World War II level of technology in terms of like bolt-action rifles, mustard gas, that kind of stuff. But there's space travel because there's magic, because you can bootstrap anything with enough magic thrown at it. There is starship combat in Athera that works a lot differently than Starfinder, if any of you have had a chance to play that so far. The ships in Athera are constructs. They work kind of like animated objects that people ride inside of. And everyone on board the ship has kind of a role in the crew. You can all contribute and work together. There's like a pilot, a gunner, a tactician, engineer. And the engineer, I love Star Trek, so one of my favorite things about it is so it's like, divert power from this to that, and make this better and that better. You can absolutely do that. In your combat, if you're like, no, we need all the power of the guns. Okay, you can divert it from the life support. And if your crew's all phalanx, who are constructs, you don't need that life support anyway. We wanted to create a setting that felt different from all of the other space fantasy stuff out there, but had touchstones that you can identify with. We have a paladin archetype in here called the Etheric Knight, and they can deflect ranged attacks with their sword, and they don't wear armor, and they are kind of force users, basically. So if you squint hard enough, you can find something you like from popular culture, and you're like, oh, that's kind of like that, okay. It's familiar, but different.
I describe the setting as a combination of Final Fantasy VI, Krull, Ice Pirates, Dune, and Eventbrite.
That is absolutely a lot of things. There is a lot of Event Horizon.
Shout out to Ice Pirates.
There is also Power Armor.
Yes.
And
we can have space for
it's relatively affordable. I ran a third level game of Athera on Thursday night for contributors, and it's like $2,000 for the first suit power armor, so it's not like you gotta wait till your 15th level to go stomping around.
This is a standard suit of plate in
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
A little
bit
more, but 1,000 more. But yeah. If you want to go stomping around and beat people up in power armor, it's not gonna take you till really long. So what I would like to do is have each of the contributing authors kind of talk a little bit about something they did or worked on in Liz's case. Maybe something that was there.
Was it the contact?
Jesse, I'm going to pick you first.
Okay.
So, and whatever you worked on, whatever you kind of are interested in, whatever you think they might find cool.
So I did some spells, I did one or two archetypes, and the artifacts. And I'd say what really sort of brought me into it was that, like Bob was saying, that there are familiar touchstones pop culturally for so many people, but it has a brand new skin that just doesn't feel like a reskin. I'll give you a perfect example is that I have a good friend who's thinking about getting into gaming, and I tend to run mostly Pathfinder. And I was talking with her about it, and I mentioned that I was working on this, and she said, oh, what's this? And I gave her sort of like a summary of Athera, and she started to salivate. And this
there are ships the size of cities.
Right. This was the thing that she wanted to get brought in on, because I think a lot of us, we may have gotten into Dungeons and Dragons, Pathfinder, what, because we had more of like a classic medieval fantasy sort of touchstone. But as we've gotten older, I think more people have different touchstones, whether that's Battlestar Galactica or it's Firefly or it's Star Blazers or whatever, and all of these things have a home here. And if not, I like what Bob said, if you squint hard enough, you can make a home for it. So I think that's one of the things really going to bring people in. And it was that integrated mythology that still had room that really made me interested, like the Athera Gates. Like, you know, I know you said that, like, now you guys can get places and there may be space zombies. But that, I almost feel like you give me too much credit. There was so much richness there. I was like, oh, man, I know exactly what I'm going to do with this. I also like the fact, too, that some of the magic needed to contend with some physics. I remember in, like, 11th grade being heartbroken when I realized sound doesn't travel in a vacuum and all of Star Wars would have been silent. I was like, oh, son of a... You know, so... But then when I had to start doing spells and I wanted them to have, like, sonic descriptors or sonic components, I had to think to myself, okay, I have to explain that this makes a bubble of oxygen in the vacuum of space, or here's how it relates to sound. So the fact that there was room for there to be actual discussion or thought of science, physics, technology, even things on the World War II equivalent era, meshed with the spells, really did feel different. It felt like a new use of something that was familiar and common. And that was one of the other things that was really rewarding about working on this, was that there was a home for new things, even within mechanics and gameplay style that felt familiar.
And to touch on something Jesse said, I actually, one of the authors that we brought on, that's a bard archetype.
Yeah.
They get kinetic blast.
They hang out on the front of the
and they are also shiny and chrome. One of the authors we brought on, Scott Young, who's at the convention today, but not here, probably running things. Has a background in astrophysics. He works at an observatory in Canada. He was our science guru for a lot of this, talking about, like, well, here's what hard science is and why that's not fun. So here's what the next step would be. And, you know, when I was like, well, here's an asteroid belt, everything's all clustered, he's like, So we had a lot of discussions about what's realistic versus what's fun, and I think we hit a really good mix of that, asteroids in question. And a lot of what meshes between the magic and the science was Scott's doing. Isabel, whatever you want to talk about, try and keep it to 15 minutes. Isabel's a talker.
I'll do what I can. So there were, I guess, three major things that come to mind for what I worked on. The first thing was, I was more or less stalked on Twitter and located by Robert. He's like, you know, I'm looking for people for this thing. You know, do you have anything I can look at? I sent him the two things I'd written thus far for, like, Wayfinder. 5 minutes later, I get a response back that's just an image macro from Hellraiser. You're not Titans. You could hear the squeak. Oh, damn. The kinds were just a delight to work on. So they're only, by my standards, lightly touched upon in the campaign setting.
Which means there's like 30 pages of them.
Yeah. They're all like that.
They're all gross. That was super two gross. People made to be one. One of them's a psychic, the other one's a physical creature. They get two separate actions in combat.
If you're familiar Ogre with
Barter Town.
If you're familiar with the Adjutant's Reaper Forces from Mass Effect 3, you made it DLC, that's kind of they're not.
So one of the things that I don't know if we've touched upon yet was the sort of cleavage from the outer plane.
So oh, yeah.
That's a good.
The traditional outer planes, heaven, hell, Elysium, not here. And when that happened, countless millennia ago, this only left some of the transitive planes, most notably the shadow plane, or as they know it, the shadow. And so the Chitons were one of the few outside races with access to Aethera, and they took advantage of that fact. And sort of spread through the system like an infection. Especially since the shadow, by its nature, mimics the material world in a dark, twisted way. So where there are gigantic cities on Akasat, there are huge cathedrals to the Chitons' religion?
And their religion is industry. Industry for the sake of industry. They're not building something to make something. That, by the way, is one of the cities on Akasat. They're not building something for a purpose. They're building something because the act of making something is their faith. They are kind of a plague of construction. They're Chitons who were separated from the idea of what Chitons are and were able to come up with a new identity for themselves. And if you've ever seen, there's an old science fiction movie, Donald Sutherland, called Parasite. That's actually kind of reminiscent to what some of the Chiton stuff came out to be, where it's like, oh, you're biological? We can make awesome, and it'll be torturous.
And so, I won't go into all the details of the Chiton organization, because...
Yeah.
but more or less, one of the big things about the Chitons of Aethera that even Chitons in other settings don't really explore as much as they could is... The Chitons kind of start with either the traditional ones, like the Evangelist or the Augur, or the new ones, like the Terpsichore. You saw them briefly earlier.
The molten people with strings and nails. That nightmare.
Indeed. We've had some bad experiences, I see. But for the most part, any Chiton you encounter in Aethera is likely to be a unique creation. It may have started with the Evangelist chassis, but then it has this, and this, and this.
The idea is there, no two Chitons you encounter should be the same. We've got some notes and rules on modifying them, because they're all about self-augmentation. And since there is analog answer to cybernetics in the setting. A lot of them have like prosthetics, or they might have just unique supernatural and spell-like abilities based on the kinds of experimentation they've been exposed to. And the new Kitans we introduced are actually modified members of all of the core races of the setting. So these were humans, and they are basically garbage. They are meat sloth cast-offs, and they're stronger in numbers than they are individually. And each of the other races were iterated into something new and terrifying to be part of the industry.
So, like, you showed them the Cirrus in the book there,
yeah.
The beast. For reasons not thoroughly explained at this time, the Kitans have an issue with the Okanta.
Which is what that race was. The Okanta, beast kind of people. And that all kind of feeds into the lore of the setting, the weird horror elements that are stalking in the shadows of it. The whole setting isn't entirely horror-driven, but if you pick up a rock and turn it over, there's probably something horrifying under it. It's an underlying current of something that if you want to do space horror or fantasy horror, it's there. But if you don't want to, it'll stay hiding in the dark watching and judging.
I can confirm that it will be there.
One of the other things Isabel talked about was the severance of the planes, and I think that's worth mentioning a little bit more too. The Athera star system out to an uncertain distance as far as the local inhabitants are concerned, beyond the solar system, there's no access to the astral plane. And that has a lot of effects. First of all, there's no teleportation method that works. Secondly, the outer planes beyond the elemental and transitive, they just can't be accessed. Thirdly, deities can't give power to their followers. They can't see the Athera system. So the gods gave up on it. There are no deities in the system. So classes that strictly revolve around deities, clerics, and war priests, they're just not. We have a section in, like, you know, do you want to be the one war priest that's ever been? You know, the first war priest, maybe you figured out a way to channel, you know, divine energy through some other means. Go ahead, but here are the societal implications of that. That's around. So, the Cantor class that David wrote up, and Oracle is kind of filling a lot of that role into my spellcasters for that. But with that severance of the planes, outsiders who were here when it happened are stuck. They can't plane shift back home. And many of them have been here for thousands of years. And since they're cut off from the planes that created them, they're no longer tethered to the moral ideologies of those planes. And they've had thousands of years to really kind of look in a mirror and be like, am I evil? And some of them say, yes, I am. And others are like, maybe I'm going to buy a boat. So, there, if you've read Occult Realms, I believe that's the book it's in, there is a section by Brandon Hawk written called Idols. And it's basically like a stone bowl that people worship that suddenly gets divine power. There's a template in here called Living Idol that can apply to outsiders. They're outsiders who are like, well, there's a tiny divine spark in me. I'm going to make a cult. And so you can have things like lawful good devils who are working in insurance or something, applying their, you know, their skills they learned. All of the outsiders that came from the outer planes typically aren't going to be in the same roles you've known them in. So if you see a Baylor, he might just be a fry cook. Or, you know, he might still be a Baylor. But you just don't know by looking at it anymore. And the Living Idol template gives them more powers the more followers they have, but it doesn't necessarily give them anything back. They might be able to grant one or two spell-like abilities, but they're not deities. They're parasites that feed on faith. Some of them use that power for good, some of them use that power for ill, some of them just want to have a job.
Devil's part-time.
So that in itself creates a unique cosmology. There is some limited teleportation effects. We created a subschool called Warping Magic that it's teleportation, but it sucks. If you've seen Harry Potter, the... The flippy teleportating thing they do where they're all like vomiting afterwards, that's basically teleportation. You're dazed afterwards. It takes a level higher of a spell to cast if you're trying to use teleport, dimension door, stuff like that. It makes people use the physical modes of transportation a little bit more, but it doesn't completely deprive you of those instant goes if you absolutely need them. it just kind of reshuffles the tactical board a bit. One of our ships.
The warping thing really gets rid of Scry and Die.
Yes.
If you show up and everybody's puking, you can't fight.
That's friends.
Quite awesome.
Yes. Art, I'm going to get to you last, because I wanted you to talk about certain things.
So, Robert approached me to do the layout for Ithera, and basically gave me free reign on the appearance of it. Basically said I need some like Art Deco elements and some space elements. I'm like, okay, now.
580 pages later.
Yeah,
page.
That's one of my favorite pages. Actually, one of my favorite pages is the one where it shows the data early on. So, one of the goals I have when I'm doing layout projects, especially the layout project of this size, is it has to be pretty, but it also needs to function as a rule book, and it needs to be usable at the table as a GM. One of the things I did, and PDF is extensively hyperlinked. Like all the spells, all the feats are automatically linked to the Pathfinder reference document. So you can just click on it and it'll take you there. Cross references in the book, like so it says see page 367, are also hyperlinked. So again, because I know as a GM, it's like, no, I need to be able to bounce around real quick. Something I'm actually pretty proud of is on these corners right here, those are like the little bump tabs. It changes depending on what part of the book you're in, what chapter you're in. So it's easy to flip through the book to get to the reference. So you can read part of what you need to get to. So those are my big goals for an older version.
Yeah, it is. I grabbed whatever was on my desktop at the moment.
Like, that's not right. yeah. There are several versions of this. so yeah, I wanted it to be functional as well as pretty. So that was one of my big goals, and it was such a treat to work on. It's like, oh, I'm working with beautiful art, the writing is really cool and interesting, and I'm just like, because you can't help but read it as you're writing it. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. some of the harder sections for me to work on was the a lot of the equipment chapter, the gear and magic chapter is really kind of difficult just because the size of it. the automata, which are again like the prosthetic replacements, that was a really fun chapter with power armor. Power armor was a lot really, really cool to read about, and I had been playing Fallout 4, so I'm like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah.
Funny how that works out. So again, the art was just fantastic and fun to work on. Although, and going in through the rounds of edits, we did have a problem with the Orbis Warrior chapter. We absolutely refused to export for editing at all. So I was like, I don't know what's wrong, but every time I tried to do it, it would crash in. Like, well,
that's appropriate for Orbis.
I know. it's very appropriate.
For those who pick up the book, that planet is kind of a pain in the ass to get to and a pain in the ass to get off of. So the fact that it was also a pain in the ass to import and export is thematically appropriate.
Yeah, I also laid out the Fair Heroes. This actually just finished this like 10 days ago was when I turned it over.
It was a rush.
It was a complete and absolute rush,
and it looks phenomenal for it. Jason Nelson from Legendary, who's hiding in the back over there.
Hi, Jason!
who's our distributor and kind of my, like, publishing mentor, was like, hey, we need something for PaizoCon. Can you get this done in like 5 days? And it's like, well, 2 weeks later, sure.
and that the Fair Heroes was pretty much, okay, I already have the page design all done. Just
and it's beautiful.
And it looks great.
So, other Liz.
So, I got referred onto this project totally blindly through one of my contacts, Adam Daigle, over at and he was like, hey, are you any interested in doing this editing gig for a third party? He was like, what the hell, why not? I need work. And so then I was like, oh, this is a really big project. and it just kept getting bigger. And so, you know, the sort of my iconic memory of this project is, you know, I get my first big chunk of work, like all chapter two, all the class work. And I'm like, okay, so like before I get into like the really like heavy like detail work of like new classes, I'll just go through the archetypes. That'll get me like into the system. I open up this file and I start going, and I finally like, this thing just is never ending. What is going on? I'm like, it's 156 pages of archetypes. I'm like, what the living hell? And then all the other sections were like 2 pages each. I was like, well, clearly I did that backwards. So I learned a lot about every single class in the Pathfinder system, including those that I have never worked on before or since and have sworn off as unplayable.
Kineticist.
Yeah, actually, kineticists are fine once you get past the words. They're told to find occultists. but the thing, so that really speaks to the playability and the extent to which the team has taken the Pathfinder rules and made them, just blended them into this setting. Anything you want to play, it's in here. There are really, really phenomenally awesome merges between the classic Pathfinder rules and the setting that we've got. You know, you have a Cavalier archetype where you're, instead of a mount, you have a speeder. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, really, really good, you know, integrated with the races, integrated with different places on different planets, integrated with the you know, different factions in the setting. So it's
the ranger that gets the aberrant companion.
It's one of the best pieces of our book.
There's a ranger archetype called the Existentialist. They get a little squiddy companion from beyond the stars, and it's just darling. The art for it,
it's
like,
so cute.
The little squid is so happy to be around.
It's great. But here's the thing, like, I then, like, when I got done with the Barrett, and then got turned around and got hired full-time to work with Paizo for Starfinder. So I'm one of the few people who's done, like, it's Snickerty. So I know both Athera and Starfinder intimately, which has been a really interesting experience, and I've had to like partition them up. But I love the Athera space combat system. I think it is a really, really well-designed approach to space combat. It is snappy. It is very team-oriented. Nobody feels like they're sitting around waiting for anyone else to do anything. It's just go, 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 go. It runs so smoothly.
And it uses the same amount of spaces and squares that regular combat does. So if you want to take your ship and turn it around and shoot somebody in the face with it, you can absolutely do that. In the game I was running on Thursday, the final encounter, which we didn't get to, it was like 2 in the morning, was going to be get to a hangar and then like 5 enemies show up, get in the ship, turn it around, and start shooting them with the ship-mounted weapons. So, you know, if you want to fight some sort of gigantic space whale with your ship, you can, and you don't have to like pull out a hex grid or something like that. You can just use, you know, your square grid maps.
Save the space whales, man.
A map of the cosmology, which is obviously not the scale, but we wanted it to have like an art deco kind of art installation feeling.
Is it art up for some kind of award?
Yeah, it was the Cartographers Guild had it up for one of the best maps of the year. And the illustrator, Francesca Barral, who works out of Italy, has the physical print, and I need to actually be here to ship it. Mm-hmm. So I don't have them on my wall. And I'll probably sell posters of it at some point once I can get around to actually putting them somewhere. So, Jacob, this goes to you, and whatever you feel like talking about, which might very well be Orisrea or it could be meat monsters, depends.
You said you want specific things for me to think about just that.
Somewhere around one of those two.
So, any specific things? Okay. Alright, so way back in the day, when we were coming up with our own worlds for the setting, when there were just two at that point, I decided I wanted, freezing cold starship troopers was basically my first idea. So Orbis Aurea, which is, of course I added another image, so now I can't remember where anything in this folder is. Orbis Aurea mostly functions around the city of Whitehaven.
That's W-I-G-H-T.
Yeah, the bad kind of Whitehaven.
Yeah.
It is in the temperate band of a frozen hellhole planet that has 8 winters a year. So its year is 8 years long, and every rotation of its lunar year caused by its equally sized moon that they orbit each other perpendicular to the rotation around the sun, there's just a narrow spot that is livable most of the year. A lot of people still harbor into glacial fjords, such as this. That enormous thing sticking out of the mountain is the anchor. That is the base of the space elevator, the only way onto and off of the planet. It is controlled by a very mysterious group of war crimes called the Paragons that were made along with one of the player character races, the Infused, except they got it extra right and regretted it immediately. So now these people are over 10 feet tall. There are only 6 surviving members of the entire project. And they all rule this planet as they see godkins, basically. Whitehaven is run by Lietka, who is a giant, mean, bully psychic.
In power armor, so he's a big guy in big power armor.
And their basic claim to fame is that since they were sent here to die and were not expected to be able to build this thing and escape the planet, they got posthumously promoted to the highest rank in the hierarchy military and used that to their advantage to control the system's pretty much last remaining source of aetherite, which this planet is filthy with.
Hey, what's aetherite?
So in the setting, there is a crystallized form of damaged ley lines that came about from an ancient apocalypse that happened in the setting. Aetherite. Humans figured out that, hey, if this shit gets struck by lightning, if this gets struck by lightning, it sublimates into an energetic plasma. And then some really smart person was like, I'm going to put this in a box and make it power things. It's super radioactive, but whatever. And all of the technology in the setting that is a weird fusion of magic and technology runs on this mineral. The humans strip-mined it off their entire world. And that caused problems. So they were like, well, let's go to our moon. We can see some on there, a telescope. So we'll build these ships and we'll go to the moon. Oh, you need atmosphere in space? All right, try to. So they get up to their moon and there's like, well, there's enough to last like 6 years. I guess we have to explore the rest of the solar system. And then war happened because that was a terrible idea. And a lot of what you encountered in the technology guide from Paizo, if you played that, where all the technology required charges and capacity, it dovetails. It works in a lot of the same way. Money in the system is also energy. Gold has no intrinsic value. It's pretty, and people play buildings with it, but you're not going to be able to buy anything with it. All of your money comes in the form of etheric units, which is a single charge of power, which is equivalent if you wanted to buy something out of the money. Books, one gold piece. You have these things called etheric capacitors, which are basically battery wallets. They're used for everything. You want to recharge your gun? Plug it in, recharge your gun. You want to cast a spell that costs it a hero component? You spray out some of the energy and weave your magic with it.
So you're literally shooting them.
Yeah, you're shooting them with money. Which basically gunslingers are with the cost of bullets. You want to power your ship, you plug it in. You want to rob somebody, you take charges out of their gun, you take charges out of their ship. It all kind of works together. We had an actual economist who wrote the economy sections of each planet to make sure that this kind of weird energy currency made sense. Because my idea for it might not have originated. But he was brilliant, and he made it brilliant.
So, other things, let's see. Orbis Aurea, World Grind the Paragons, largest source of aetherite. They're basically using the only access point on their planet in order to control the entire trade of the most precious substance in the system. But they have their own problems. Since thousands of years ago, the planet was hit by a meteorite of some sort, which blasted a lot of really weird, not actual aetherite into the atmosphere, creating what they call the nethersphere. This is negative energy and charged aetherite. If you drive an aethership through it, it will shut your engine off and you will crash and die. If you try to fly one out of the planet, the same thing will happen. The first settlers of the planet are the survivors of the first voyage to this planet from the hierarchy. And the Paragons, they assumed, would also just die when they sent them there. But that was sent into the air by a rock that was carrying... Let's see. These guys. So, there is a horrible nightmare psychic bug threat on the planet. It's digging up through all the tunnels and stealing people and doing weird things to them. They come in various shapes and sizes.
They eat aetherite for snacks.
And sometimes they make you eat aetherite for snacks.
And turn you into one of those.
There's a lot of that going around.
There is a lot of that going around. And I had a discussion at one point with Isabel. What happens when these two meet? And it's not good.
You'll see.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Body horror.
So these are the biggest existential threat to people on Orbis. Yeah, that most people are aware of. Even the Chitons don't like this place. For several reasons, which is generally less likely you'll see them storming a place. But these guys are unstoppable, they can't be reasoned with, and there's an all-out war being waged at them in the edge of basically every Paragon-controlled area. So the world is, like I said last year, where you send your players when they have displeased you. It's also a massive new burgeoning economy for where most of the cast-offs of the war went to live. because all of the infused and phalanx who were basically booted out of human society needed a place to go, and the Paragons like to take anyone who the hierarchy doesn't and make friends with them. Because you need all the friends.
The infused and phalanx are two of the new races we introduced in the book. The infused are humans who were experimented on, and someone had the brilliant idea, let's pop the aetherite in their veins and see what happens. The answer was telekinetic powers. Unfortunately, it doesn't always go so well, as pictured in this. It not only wiped most of their memories, but shortened their lifespan to about 15 to 20 years, and sterilized them. So they have no way of saving themselves as a species, and they're all going to die out. So they have a very desperate desire to figure out what was done to them and how to either undo it or make it not so bad. The other race, the Phalanx, are constructs. They are not quite androids. They're not quite full-on machines. If you're familiar with Eberron, they're a little bit more like the Warforged, and then they have a constitution score. They're alive. They don't breathe. They don't need to eat or drink, but they consume aetherite kind of like a little snack.
And sometimes they are absurdly dapper.
Yes.
I call them Zoot Flute.
The Phalanx were found in a vault on a moon, and the humans were like, well, we're in a war. We're just going to turn these guys on and plug them full of aetherite to power them up. Not realizing that what aetherite really was, and that fragments of living souls were endowed into these constructs, and that they started to have people memories from who knows when. And the Phalanx are trying to figure out their role, their identity. They were liberated from their servitude with humanity, and they're basically like, well, your people, do what you want. We just don't want to give you a position of authority because you might be mad at us. So the Phalanx are very individualist, but they also have human affectations, so they wear clothes. They don't need to, but they do. Not all of them, as evidenced in our Thursday game. But they are a construct-like race. They're treated as constructs for all, like, most of the immunities they have in mind. Most of them aren't even mind-affecting effects and stuff. But they're an interesting race, and they can tap into those, like, fragmentary memories of, like, past existences and have sort of, like, Brawler's martial flexibility as a once-a-day power that they can use. Except they're not limited to combat needs. They just have to be prerequisites for it. And they're... One of the other new races, the Okanta, are the other one. They are huge beast people. They can have any kind of mammal head of any kind with horns. No matter what they are, they're going to have horns. If the animal already had horns, they have extra horns. And when I came up with them, I was like, okay, well, we're going to put, you know, a couple different kinds of animals in the book. Great. People come up with the weirdest combinations for this that I never would have imagined.
Wolvertinger.
There was a bunny Okanta in our Thursday game, which was adorable. And there's a propaganda poster being made for the Intrigue Manual, which I'll talk about in a second, that has a walrus Okanta. And I was just like, as soon as I saw the picture, I like squeaked and was like, this is amazing.
I'm still looking forward to laying
out. I assume he has a monocle.
Unfortunately, no. He does have an engine on his shoulder, though. So that's like just scratching the surface of what you're going to find in the core book.
You should probably just touch on the last new race since you've got all the
animals. Oh, yes, that's right. The Arathi. I forgot all about them.
So they weren't racist.
So the Arathi are plant creatures. They're native outsiders. They're effectively like Orid, Ifrit, Sylph, except their element is wood. And they are considered both humanoids and plants for purposes of spells that affect them. And they have an entire planet all their own. Yes, they are agendered. They don't necessarily present as male or female, though some that have kind of acclimated human society are like, this is fun. And they decide to.
Gender, how fascinating.
Exactly. The phalanx are the exact same way. They're machines. They don't have any kind of gender. But some of them are like, no, remodel me. I want to be a woman. That's awesome. And the Arathi are a very different society from humanity. They have an unusual similarity in their languages and some of their societal trends of like, I can't remember the word for it now, but it's a meritocracy. They're both in a form of meritocracy, but in different sides of the spectrum. And the Arathi were, the humans were the two races that fought against one another in the Century War.
The Arathi are very tasty.
Yeah, very, very caste structured. And they fought against one another in the Century War, which was for Aether, right? Humans showed up in their home world and were like, hey, we're going to strip mine this school, right? And they were like, these are our sacred things. And there was a very long 100-year ongoing war that ended just a handful of years prior to when the set begins. What stopped it is the overarching enemy of the entire kind of campaign setting. A extra solar system enemy came through the gatehubs. Their ships are hollowed out planetoids, moons, asteroids, and sometimes entire planets that have been hollowed out. They're the Tor, and they are spacefaring former Baphomet worshipping Minotaur, whose whole goal is we eat the strong and kill the weak. And they showed up unprepared for exactly what the Aetheris system wants. They were cut off from the demon god. And they decided, well, religion has failed us. And they ate their priests.
The priest feast.
They had the priest feast. And then while they were being shot at by every other race in the system in the middle of this war, someone came up with an offer to them. They're like, well, your ships were powered by divine energy and worship. That's obviously not working for you. You were getting shot out of the sky. How do you like shadows? And the Chitons came to them with an offer. Work with us. Do one favor for us. We'll get your ships out. And that's when those two horrible forces aligned. They've been hiding in the dark of space, kidnapping people from colonies. And that's kind of where the setting is at right now. No one exactly knows what the Tor want, where they came from, why they exist. And very few people even know the Chitons exist at all. And if you look in the bestiary section, the DCs for identifying them are astronomically high. You're typically going to be the first person to encounter one when you do. You're going to report to people who believe you. So that kind of covers like just a little bit of all of this. I want to make sure we have time to talk about the second book that we're coming up with, which is the Intrigue Manual. This book gets into the factions, the politics, the kind of interesting conflicts throughout the system, not only between the major races and the homeworlds, but also what are the Tor doing, what do they want, what are their goals, who are their leaders. And we're introducing rules for running propaganda systems. So say you don't like this faction, you want to turn an entire civilization against them, there are mechanics for how you can do that on a scale from a single hamlet to an entire planet, depending on how many resources you have. We're also introducing a new class in the Intrigue Manual, which is the Detective, which is a variant class of the Inquisitor. Or the Investigator, thank you. Instead of how the Investigator gets alchemy and kind of is a weird kind of a Sherlock Holmesy character, the detectives are hard-boiled film noir detectives. They don't get spell-like abilities. They get something kind of like an Oracle revelation, which is called their...
It's not called Hunch. You get demoted.
It's not, but they have an ability called Hunch. It's called their case. Yes, their case is a revolving kind of focus that they have. So like their current case is an occult mystery. So they've got the occult case, and that gives them a suite of powers to investigate the occult. Okay, now I'm investigating war crimes. My third level ability allows me to swap out, okay, now I'm a war detective, so I'm going to investigate war crimes, and that gives you a new suite of powers. And we've introduced, and that's our iconic detective. The contrast is a little weird with that. But the detective class is going to be very more focused on not only being kind of an investigator, but also being kind of an anti-rogue in a lot of ways that the investigator isn't. Oh, you have a disguise? I can pick that apart, figure out who you are, and figure out who you work for just by the things you're wearing. They're very focused on finding out information and leveraging that against their enemies in a lot of different ways. They can case a location. So say you need to go invade a specific building, go to a ruin. They can check it out for a couple of days and then build a plan, and then as long as you follow their instructions, you get bonuses while you're there, kind of like favorite terrain. And we built archetypes for them that follow a lot of kind of like thematic detectives. There's the corrupt cop. I forget what we called that archetype in the end. But it's basically the Harvey Bullock of the detectives, who's on the take. You have crime world connections, and you're going to basically be a little skeevy and underhanded. There's one that focuses on a lot of gunplay, so if you want to be that shoot first, ask questions later detective, that's there too. There is a psychic detective who focuses on more of the occult aspects. We wanted to make the detective feel distinct from both investigator and inquisitor, and I think we hit a pretty interesting line for it. We're hoping to have this out and run into the year fall-ish. It's going to be a... thank you for flipping this. I almost forgot to mention. In the Aetheric campaign setting, we did something where every chapter has a two-page comic book spread in it that kind of gives you a little bit of the lore, gives you a little bit of the visual theme of the setting. We got comic artist Alicia Marie Riddell to do the introductory comics for all the chapters in the Intrigue Manual. This is a draft sketch she sent me just a few days ago, actually, of the inks for page one of the comics showing an arrival to the city of Central in Akasat and someone on a mission. So you can kind of get like a snap of that flavor and learn more about the world just by reading the introduction of chapters more than like a paragraph blurb might give you. We're also having some propaganda posters for the world itself set in each of the chapters too, so you can kind of see like the humans, they don't trust spellcasters that aren't registered, so it's your duty to report them. Once we've finished with the Intrigue Manual, there are also a handful of adventures that are... Oh yeah, the Intrigue Manual also has some new automata, which are kind of like cybernetic implants, but not quite. They're a little bit clunkier. Our artist, Joel Niles, did all of the mechanical designs for the book. You'll see a lot of the blueprints in the equipment section of the campaign set. And he designed some phenomenal black and white sketch art that we're going to convert into blueprints. The Intrigue Manual is going to be a soft cover about the size of like an adventure path. We're still narrowing down exactly where the page count's going to land. I have very good authors and I hate cutting their stuff. The plain section in this book, by the way, was written by Todd Stewart, speaking of overwriting. He wrote the Pathfinder Book of the Planes, so there's a lot of synergy there with what Pathfinder's planes are, with what Todd's vision of. Severed planes are. We also have a series of adventures that we're going to be putting out staggered throughout the course of the year. The first one, Wanted in Wastes, is being run at the convention. There are three tables of it. And that is a desert exploration adventure where you're looking for someone who is missing, who's being hunted because they are an unregistered magic user and someone reported them. And that's a first level adventure, kind of gives you an introduction to the human homeworld, what the wastelands beyond the cities are like. It's kind of got a Mad Max-y vibe to it. Amber Scott wrote it, the guest of honor this year, and she is very shiny and chrome and loves all of that like post-apocalyptic kind of feel, which you get when you leave the cities on the human homeworld. The second
perfect place to add all your dark.
Yes, yes, yes. If you read the environment section, our author who did that was also a huge fan of Dark Sun, so there's a lot of just like the desert is going to eat you alive content in here. Our second adventure is Murder in the Midlands. Isabel wrote that. That's a murder investigation adventure set in the Arcology City of Central, which is that big spire city you saw in some of the art. Murder in the Midlands is about cult activity and what happens inside of Metropolis when those sorts of things start spreading around. Our third adventure is written by Mike Wellum, who you might remember from RPG Superstar and having written books. It is Children of the Collapse. It takes place on the Arathi homeworld of Kir Sharat, and it is about exploring not only the Arathi cities, but the secrets that are inside of their the gigantic trees their cities are built in, and then the forbidden lightless realms below the canopy of the Dark Wild, and a little bit of political intrigue of fighting between the Arathi factions who might not want the war to have ended and are looking for ways to reignite it. Our last adventure, which I demoed here last year, is Beacon in the Black, and that's also his only adventure. Beacon in the Black is our love letter to Event Horizon. The gas giant of Sorreos has a dreadnought ship the size of a city floating in. It was lost during the war, and it suddenly resurfaces and starts boosting an emergency signal. You fly out there with a salvage crew, and everything goes wrong. And it is, that's the Radiant Beacon. That's where the adventure takes place. It has some problems, as you might notice. and it is a exploration horror adventure, and it's one of the favorite things I've ever worked on developing. It just has a very creeping sense of dread about it that builds up and builds up and builds up until the climax at the end. It starts out very innocent. You're like, oh, we're exploring a gas giant. Here's some hex maps. Fun adventures. And then you get in the ship and it's like, oh no, this was a bad choice.
Mistakes were made.
It's a bad choice. It's a bad choice. Mistakes were made. So we're also planning on doing few more adventures in 2018. I haven't quite figured out what they're going to be yet. But Thurston Hillman, who designed our space combat section, is working on a kind of TBD project for us. It's, if you've ever read the old Forgotten Realms book, Myth Draenor, which was kind of about like a massive war in the Forgotten Realms setting, and it kind of showed you like, here's where this happened, here's when that happened. It's going to be about the Century War, if you wanted to say play in that time period. And here's where things get all flaggy and arrowy, and here's what that means. And then also at the end of the book, here's some current stuff that ties into all of that. And that's going to be a book that Thurston's kind of writing when Starfinder isn't eating his soul. Because he's now responsible for organized play for that. And Isabel's probably going to tear my arms off and write an adventure in my blood at some point.
I have better things to write.
She doesn't want your
so
no, you need that to develop it.
I just don't need eyes where I'm going.
Yeah.
So
it grows
back. So that's kind of where we're at for products right now. We've also talked about 2018 being where we branch out to doing a few novels in the setting. Where we branch out to maybe working on graphic novels are also possibly happening. Our comic has been very well received. The comics in our books have been very well received, and we've been talking with a couple of really big name comic artists and writers to work on something for us in the future. And there's also maybe a board game being developed, and if you wanted to demo that, maybe you talk to Nick today sometime.
I hear good things.
It's in the very early stages, but we're kind of like testing the waters and seeing what something kind of like a MOBA, like battle arena in a board game looks like. So that's where we are for this year and the start of next year. We've got plans to either do a book on the technology called the Aether Tech Manual, which will have more power armor and more weapons, more technology, information on the corporations and factions in the setting, or a bestiary that's more like a natural philosopher's field guide that has a lot more lore for monsters in it rather than just an A through Z, here are some monsters. It's going to have like sketches of them, drawings of like people, like big game hunters posing next to some of the monsters. Like, I want it to feel different from a regular bestiary. I'm just not sure which one we're going to do first.
It's kind of like the old Ben Richten's guide.
Yes, yes, a lot like the old Ben Richten's guide, the Volos guides, those kinds of things.
I still am like an ultimate campaign
kind of
background.
Yeah.
So that's what I want.
So
it's the ultimate campaign.
Well, more of like building backgrounds and traits.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I invested
in. Yeah.
That's something I'd actually be really
excited. You can see my writers chirping with little birds with words. So since we've only got a little bit of time left, I figured I'd
being like How many minutes over now?
Well, not technically over. But so I want to kind of turn it back. Does anybody have questions or things they wanted to ask about the setting?
If outsiders have no way to get back home, I'm assuming there's also no way to banish them either.
Banishment is a tricky prospect. Banishment isn't a teleportation subschool effect, so it does actually work on them. That's kind of the one thing that's terrifying to them, is they've been gone so long, so if a good devil gets banished back to hell, what happens? And Todd, Stuart talked my ear off about doing a planes book at some point, and that's a question we'd answer there.
How many classes do you use the guns? It seems like if the monetary value of a great hand is equal to, like, you know, you get, you might run into a case where people are, like, not, like, taking action. So, like, well, I don't want to waste my money if I can shoot. So, like,
it's similar in Pathfinder, because, like, with a gunslinger, bullets are about one gold piece a piece anyway, so you're kind of firing your money off anyway. But there is almost more melee activity going on in this. We've got a bunch of classes that focus on just closing the distance, ignoring gunfire, and beating you about the head and neck. So
there's the
Titan Brawler. Yeah, there's the Titan Brawler. There's a good mix of if you want to focus on ranged, if you want to focus on melee, and the balance of the player economy isn't really any different from regular Pathfinder. It just seems a little more frightening at first because everything uses the money out of your pocket, but at the end of the day, you're spending it in basically the same way. We put a lot of care into making sure that, like, no one gets too hesitant about spending it, and you can basically always find money everywhere immediately. You don't have to necessarily go back to town to sell your things because, say, you fight, like, a group of mercenaries, some of their guns are going to have ammunition on them, which you can then plug into your gun. Regular guns still fire, like, physical bullets, so that's also kind of a... There's some rules in here for how intricate into guns do you want to get. Like, we have optional rules for recoil and for, like, different calibers of bullets if you want to get that in the nitty-gritty of it, or if it's just one size fits all. So we accommodate a couple of different play styles with it, but it plays well so you don't feel like you have to really conserve that particular...
There's also restrictions on accessibility of the firearms and the weapons and fashions, like some of them like military only. And there's that built into the system as well. And I think there's also a lot more room in the setting for more non-lethal approaches, as opposed to a more standard, you know, fantasy kind.
Yeah, that was actually something I specifically wanted to address. So one of the earliest, we have standard firearms. And we also have magic firearms that fire bolts of etheric energy or whatever. And they're just, you know, plug in your wallet and it's a giant clip. The, like, very base level Aethertech firearm is basically a stun gun. So it's real cheap, and also it deals non-lethal damage for people who are more interested in maybe not murdering everything ever.
Yeah, and political intrigue and stuff is one of, like, my bread and butters, which is why the first book we did was the Intrigue Manual, and we wanted to have, like, the political setup of the system be very meaty, so you can really get into just, like, I'm going to ruin you financially, you know, and that kind of thing, and that can be an entire adventure of just, like,
I don't know about your travel.
Exactly. It might not be as flashy as Phantom Menace's trade regulations, but that all can be there if you like that. Other questions?
Except for going straight into novels, is there ever any time for short fiction or anything like that?
It depends on kind of the venue for it. Paizo got away with a lot of that with the Adventure Paths, having, like, yeah, novellas there. If we can figure out a product to put it in, yes. I guess we could do an anthology. That is true. We'll talk to you about that later. but yeah, I think that's something that we could definitely do, because there was a lot of short fiction that kind of came about for having to write the backgrounds for the Iconics, and people really gravitated to doing that. So I think there's really room for that. Oh yeah, I forgot to sell that. So has any of you played Dragon Age or heard about it? The creator of it's working on the Intrigue Manual. David Gator is kind of a acquaintance come good friend of mine, and I talked to him about the project, and he's like, oh man, I wish I had an idea for it. I'd totally write for it. Halfway through the production cycle, he's like, I came up with an idea. I guess it's too late. I'm like, I am making page count for you. He is writing a section on... subjective history. It's like, you know, you believe that this, that, and this are true. What happens when you find out your life is a lie? And there's a whole section for GMs and players about what that means for good GMing of that and not, like, abusing the player's trust. And Dave's focus on that was fantastic. And he loves the setting. He downloaded the PDF and he's like, what the hell is this? He's like, because it was so big. And then by the time it was done, he's like, I love when I pick up something and it immediately gives me ideas. He's like, I have ideas. So he wants to stay on board and write more for us. So I'm going to find whatever opportunity I can to have someone who's basically my idol write for them.
He's like, I have a cat that I named after one of the Indiana Jones characters. He's like, oh my gosh.
I buried the lead there on that. I forgot all about that. Thanks, Liz, for reminding me. Other questions?
Actually, there are too many questions. But I like, yeah, I just picked this up, look at it, like, okay, how's this? So I just came in just to see what's going on.
Yeah.
And I can see what you talk about. Dark Sun, Nevermind, how the influence is game. And then the basic Pathfinder rules all apply here.
Yep.
The CD.
Yep.
CD,
all of that's the same.
And range combat.
Yep.
Or
cover and all that works.
Touch, that kind of stuff.
Yep. There's some new stuff we added to kind of accommodate for the fact that there's a lot of guns, so touch AC is going to be important. There are armor upgrades called ballistic enhancements that can help you give half your armor bonus to your touch AC against guns specifically, so you're not just like, I'm in full plate and useless. My power armor does nothing to bullets.
Yeah. The gear and gadget trackers.
Yeah, and we wanted it to be like, do you have the core rulebook? Cool, you can play it there. Do you have all the other books? You get more of them.
Yeah, there's a section in the bestiary of, here's some Aethera-appropriate creatures for bestiary 1 through 5.
And here's where they are.
Here's where they are, what kind of same level
of synergy.
Actually,
yeah.
I can kind of touch on the whole new products thing. Around the time we were writing this, like, Ultimate Intrigue hit somewhere in there.
Just came out,
so
yeah.
one of our contributors who couldn't be here, Joshua Rivera, took the vigilante
thing for
it and just went wild. So
one
Asteroid City is just filled with, like, masked heroes fighting the...
That is worth mentioning.
Everything Josh writes is worth mentioning.
There's an asteroid colony full of masked superheroes who basically have built their own society. It's very, like, if you've ever seen, like, the old Japanese show Kamen Rider, like, it's a lot like that meets, like... any Sentai thing like Power Rangers, and one of them is a crime lord masquerading as a hero who runs the entire city and is tricking them all into fighting each other to keep the power balance. And I'm actually finally getting him illustrated in the Intrigue manual.
Yes.
He's like a red armored superhero in like a white fur collar jacket, and he's like the most fabulous
like
person in the world.
Sentai.
Yeah. Unless there were any other questions, I'm going to get around to, if anyone's interested in getting this broken baby, give me a show of hands, because one of these cards will get you. Who wants in on that?
Can we also talk about what class we want to play?
Oh, feel free while I'm figuring this out. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, that is easy breezy. I am going to shuffle.
So, and having not actually, like, done any sort of playtest or writing, I really want to play
five, not ready.
I don't care what it is, I'm going to play it. That was my first thought, I always want to be human. And the first thing I read was, I
want to
be a
phalanx.
So
nice! I was ridiculous about that.
I'm like really interested in the Rift Breaker, but the Jump Trooper.
I can tell you, it's awesome.
Jump Trooper, I love like being able to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Who has the card with the smiley face on the sun?
I tried really hard to.
Yes.
Congratulations! You got the broken baby. Busted, but
we hear rubber glue is good for that.
Yes, we hear that rubber cement is good for
it. Real good too. Much card back?
No, I keep it. It's got the website address on it. And if anyone else wants a card at the end of the panel, feel free to come up and grab one. And since I'm here as well, who else had a card? So it was the three of you. You already got a book. So 1, 2, 3 of you left.
card?
I know I do.
Okay, who has the smiley sun again?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you got it?
Yay!
You got a free copy of Their Heroes. So you can check us out at therarpg.com. It has links to everywhere you can buy the book. The PDF's out right now. The hardcover will be out somewhere between now and August, whenever I can get the books out from the warehouse.
You can pre-order it at WesleryGames.com.
Yep.
NatureGameLegendary.com. Pre-order it. So we've already got the best people who pre-order it there, and you'll be in the first batch that goes out.
Yep.
And you can order it, both the book and the book PDF up.
Yep.
And Robert really advocated for the fans. And the pricing of this book.
Yeah.
I told him, you are a sucker.
Again, the PDF is extensively hyperlinked.
Yes.
So, please enjoy.
What are we charging for the hardcover?
What are we charging for the hardcover? The hardcover is $59.99 for 583 pages.
Yeah.
Which is shockingly inexpensive.
Jason about had a stroke when I told him what I wanted to charge for the book. He's like, you could charge 80. I'm like, no.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.